Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
An unusual response to this recession.
I like that.
When millions of Americans were riding the subprime mortgage roulette wheel, Behrouz Shahidi advised his clients to steer clear of too much house. They're grateful and still listening to him, even though his business is down.
Look at this office. At one point, this used to be so busy, you couldn't even hear yourself think. But look, nobody's here. I like it. I can't think.
The story of a recession hero and his economic theory. Don't worry, be...
I like that.
We're serious. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, March 27th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is out spending time with her new baby. And coming up this hour, we'll talk about the legacy of Three Mile Island, where a nuclear meltdown occurred 30 years ago this Sunday. We'll check in with Femi Okeh, who's been out on assignment looking for heroes. You heard the laugh of that one hero. That's Mr. Shahidi, who's a real estate broker. We're going to hear from a Zambian economist who says aid for Africa is a waste of money. All those stories, but first, headlines. In Fargo, North Dakota, the Red River versus the Sandbaggers. An overnight score won for the river. Residents in a neighborhood in South Fargo were awakened in the middle of the night and told to evacuate after authorities found a significant leak in a dike. Fargo resident Ney Mayhews says there's a reason why he and so many others are working hours on end to lay down the sandbags.
The water's not laughing at my door right now, but if these dikes break, the whole town's going to go underwater.
Forecasters say the Red River may hit a record 43 feet above flood stage over the weekend. President Obama expected to announce a new strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan this morning. In Afghanistan, 4,000 more troops or trainers will be sent to help build up the Afghan army on top of 17,000 additional troops he's already approved. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said there will also be hundreds of civilian advisors going along, too, trying to win the hearts and minds.
It is an integrated military-civilian strategy. And we are convinced that that's the most critical underpinning of any success we hope to achieve along with the people and government of Afghanistan.
The strategy for Pakistan involves boosting aid. In northwestern Pakistan today, 48 people are reported dead in a suicide bombing at a mosque packed for Friday prayers. Mark Garrison, what else is going on?
Good morning, John. In Washington, top bankers are having a lunchtime meeting with the president at the White House. They'll talk about reviving the economy and potential new financial regulations.
Peanut butter sandwiches at that lunch?
I don't know what they're serving. We'll find out. We'll check the menu. The president will also, of course, check in on how credit markets are faring. Overseas, Japan says it will use military interceptors if necessary to destroy any parts of a North Korean rocket from an expected missile test that might fall on its territory. The decision comes after North Korea says it's preparing to launch a communication satellite, but most people believe that's actually going to be a long-range missile test.
All right, the Dow and the S&P took a jump yesterday, about 2%. The S&P begins trading today at 8:33. We'll see what happens. Later on in the show, our own Femi Okeh brings us the story of a recession hero, kind of a sandbagger along the recession river, someone who's resisted the temptation of jumping into the growing bubble, and his clients are very, very grateful for that. Maybe there's someone who helped you out or a friend of yours in this recession who's your recession hero. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. This is my new favorite response to the recession, and it's not the voice of Timothy Geithner.
I like that.
Infectious. That's Behrouz Shahidi. We'll be hearing his story later on in the program from Femi Oke, one of our recession heroes. We want to hear from yours. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So the next story is not funny. 30 years ago on Saturday, the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant turned fears of atomic nuclear energy into a civilian fear of nuclear power plants. Bruce Smith, the commissioner of Newberry Township, Pennsylvania. This is at a demonstration just a few days after the Three Mile Island shutdown. It's still called one of the worst nuclear disasters in American history.
Sure, a few protesters warned us, but we didn't heed their warnings. Instead, we believed the experts who said nuclear power was the safest energy man could produce. We believe the scientists who said the possibility of nuclear accident was...
The belief in nuclear power was rattled by the Three Mile Island accident, but much has changed in 30 years. And in June of 2005, President Bush, speaking to nuclear workers, says that the legacy of Three Mile Island is over and it's time to think anew about nuclear power.
That frightened a lot of folks. Yet people have got to understand that advances in science and engineering and plant design have made nuclear plants far safer than ever before.
So in the aftermath of oil price spikes that were historic last summer, and a looking forward in the stimulus package and a vision for an energy future that is projected by Barack Obama, we thought this anniversary was pretty significant in the news, far more than just historical. And joining us to talk about it is Jonathan McClellan, who's president of the New York City chapter of the United States Association for Energy Economics. He's here in the studio. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
And Christian Parenti, a contributing editor at The Nation, also here with us. So, Christian, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So let's talk. It seems to me that, you know, the China syndrome kind of Hollywood evocation of nuclear fears is at both relevant and cliche, thinking 30 years after Three Mile Island. How are we to put the fears that were talked about in the aftermath of Three Mile Island into context for a 21st century world that's more concerned, it seems to me, more frightened of high oil prices and diminished fossil fuel and even climate change than they are nuclear energy? Christian?
Well, I think actually that the threats are very much the same, because what we're dealing with is very much the same fleet of reactors. There are 103 reactors around the country in 64 places, and they're all now about 40 years old. And there's this discussion about this new type of nuclear power and new fleet of reactors. But the economics for that don't work out. The Bush administration put $18 billion worth of government subsidies on the table several years ago, and no one has bitten at it. And meanwhile, what's going on, because the economics of new power plants don't work, what's happening is a new set of firms like Entergy, which own these old plants, have been applying for and receiving relicensing. So plants that were designed to last 40 years are now getting licenses to operate for 60 years, and in many cases at 120% of their designed and intended capacity.
All right,
and
so
that,
Christian,
I think, is
very
risky.
Christian says old plants are scary, but is there a business model for new technology, new nuclear power plants, Jonathan McClellan?
I think certainly there are now incentives in place that weren't there a number of years ago. Certainly the Energy Policy Act of 2005 put in loan guarantees, as Christian mentioned. Whether these plants get built or not is still a challenge. There is a long regulatory review process. And the fact is that no plants have been built for a couple of decades.
And the waste problem has not been solved, not really even been addressed, even though there's this theoretical idea that it's going to all be put in Yucca Mountain. What's the status of that at this point?
Well, I think Yucca Mountain is looking less and less likely at this stage. The alternative at the moment is to store the waste on site. So the problem of nuclear waste has not yet been solved.
It seems to me that one of the real legacies, and for both of you, I suspect you may have something to say on this, the real legacies of Three Mile Island, aside from our fears of a nuclear meltdown or the China syndrome or anything like that, the real legacy is that with nuclear power and with the Three Mile Island accident, suddenly consumers began to look at the real cost of their energy, and it had almost nothing to do with the utility bill that they received. And that is something that has had implications for fossil fuels, hydroelectric power. The real cost of energy was something that began with nukes, and we're still dealing with it now, even with coal and other fossil fuels. Jonathan, and then Christian.
Certainly, I think there's an awareness that came out of Three Mile Island of the safety issues and waste issues. But this is not simply confined to the nuclear industry. If you look at the coal ash spill in Tennessee in December of 2008, is a massive environmental disaster. And I think people are certainly aware of these issues, and especially global warming impacts pretty much everything that we do in the energy industry.
Energy use has costs. Do you think the Obama administration has the political courage to remove the kind of blinders that conceal the real cost of energy, whether we're talking about nukes or coal, Christian?
I would hope so. But, I mean, Obama has a sort of spotty record on atomic power. You know, one of his main advisors, David Axelrod, has worked very closely with the atomic energy industry and received a lot of money consulting for them. And Obama has promised huge amounts of subsidies for new atomic plants. But during his campaign, he at least did not support relicensing. And that's really the whole issue. In this conversation, we're always talking about what I really think is totally irrelevant and not going to happen, which is building new power plants.
It never happen?
It's not going to happen because the economics of it simply
don't
work.
But how do they do it in France and not do it here in the United States?
They did it, one, a long time ago when safety regulations weren't as strict. In France, they have a single model and a single company that receives massive government support. The French atomic power industry, like the Japanese, does not run on a profit and loss basis. It's very much about the strategic nature of nuclear power in France is subsidized by the rest of the economy so that France has a physically independent source of power, right, which so we now see is totally filthy because the Rhone or one of the major river systems there has become badly contaminated by that. So,
but even in the United States, with wider geographic, greater dispersion of the plants, they're of necessity concentrated in France, and there are environmental consequences. That could we adopt that French model of a massive subsidy? The Department of Energy basically becomes the Department of Nuclear Energy.
We actually have that, and you know, the largest bankruptcy, government bankruptcy, municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history is for nuclear bonds. The power crisis,
the Washington
in
public power
exactly.
supply system,
the California power crisis. A lot of that was about the debt accrued by old nuke plants. So there already is a program of public subsidy for mopping up the old costs. I do not think that it's realistic to think that the system we have here of many competitive private firms, all with different models for how they're going to build power plants, could be turned into something like the French version of the industry.
Jonathan McClellan, is nuclear power of necessity or ultimately impeded by a group of zealots who will accept no argument in favor of this non-carbon-producing energy source?
Well, I'm not necessarily pro or against nuclear, but I think the discussion of the topic is nuanced, and meeting the energy needs of America and indeed the world is a complex issue. Nuclear certainly has its benefits in terms of zero emissions, but there are other challenges. And I think to say Obama is pro-nuclear or anti-nuclear and have that very simple discussion needs to move on and get a bit more sophisticated.
Will a new nuclear plant be built in the United States in the next 10, 15 years?
If you look at the timeline, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is set to make decisions on currently 17 companies have made applications to build plants. That decision will come out in 2011, 2012.
At the fastest track, what could actually be built?
Well, after that, it's going to take at least 4 to 5 years to actually build a plant. And this is assuming that you have financing lined up, you don't run into construction issues, all of these things that are going to come into play. That simply haven't been tested in the last 20 or so years.
The fact is, the atomic power industry has been waiting for 100% subsidy and guarantee. They have about 80% guaranteed, and they will not commit to providing the other 20%, or they can't get banks to commit to providing the other 20% of funding. And so, I mean, that says something about the dangers of this technology and the problems in financing it. Until they have the government backing 100% of their potential losses, they're really not going to build.
It's a business question, not necessarily a technological one. Jonathan McClellan, president of the New York City chapter of the United States Association for Energy Economics, and Christian Parenti, contributing editor at The Nation. Thanks to both of you for thinking 30 years after the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster and what that means for nuclear energy going forward.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Maybe it's just me, but I'm really attracted by this recession sandbagging metaphor as we watch the waters rise in Fargo, North Dakota, and that community coming together to deal with the flooding. Femi Okeh, later on in the program, is going to give us a profile of someone we like to call a recession sandbagger, a bit of a hero, someone who resisted the temptation of a growing housing and economic bubble and steered his customers to a place that they're very glad they ended up in today. We're looking for other heroes, too. Maybe it's you. Maybe it's someone who helped you out or a friend of yours.
Hi, my name is Steve Cooper, Joplin, Missouri. I'm a business owner, work two other jobs to keep my business going, and there has been some people that stepped up this year and have helped me, float me some very short-term loans, help me keep my electric on here, gas on there, and they're the heroes, the people that can reach out to a family or friend and help them to endure the hard times.
That's what we like to hear. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. In this next segment, another profile, but of someone in Africa who perhaps typifies a new breed of leadership on the continent as things change. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is the first woman to be democratically elected to lead an African nation. She's the leader of Liberia, and it's made Liberia a focal point for the advancement of women in Africa, as well as political changes that are taking place on the continent. And here with that profile, and to tell us more about this fascinating character who's on her way to the United States, releasing a book about her life. She's just been interviewed by Lynn Scherr, who we are delighted to have here, special correspondent for PBS, former ABC News reporter, and former colleague of mine. Lynn, thanks so much for coming in. And what do I need to know about Ellen Johnson Sirleaf before she arrives here in the United States?
Hi, John. So nice to be with you.
It's
again.
Great to be
this
here.
Is cool.
Yes, indeed.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is an inspiration. I just spent almost two weeks in Liberia reporting for World Focus, the PBS show.
Right.
And I was there for a four-day International Women's Colloquium. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was elected largely by women. She supports the women who supported her. This was a give back to them, but because she wants to lift Liberia and lift women at the same time, she thinks that's the way it's going to work. She is an extraordinary woman. This is a country that is war-torn. There are bullet holes everywhere. It's hot, it's humid, it's steamy. But I have to tell you, John, it is inspiring because they are really trying to come back. And she's the one leading the effort.
Well, let's listen to some of the voice of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf from your interview earlier this month.
Yeah, let me just set it up. I asked her, this is from her book, This Child Will Be Great, her memoir coming out next week. And in the book, she writes, the women out there, when she was campaigning for president in 2005, said to her, men have failed us. Let's listen to her response to that.
You know, we have 161 years of independence in Liberia. We've been ruled by men all along at the top level, and decision-making in our country has been concentrated at the top level. And so when they say men has failed us, it's a reflection of the fact that even though we've had women in government holding sometimes high positions, but the decision was made at the center, and it's always been the male. The fact that we had wars, again, it comes from a leadership either by omission or commission that enabled those wars to go on. So what the women were saying is, now it's time for change. It's time for us to, you know, to come behind a woman who we think has the qualification and the commitment and the courage.
Wow. That's change with a capital C there in Liberia. And we should remind our listeners that Liberia has a fascinating history that's linked with the United States, as well as the sort of patriarchy that she describes there.
Indeed it is. Part of my interview, by the way, will be running on Tuesday night on World Focus,
right.
And folks can check their local PBS station to find out when it's running. It'll also be online, www.worldfocus.org. Had
Excellent.
To get that in,
Excellent.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
U.S. relations. Liberia, partly founded by freed American mm-hmm. blacks who were sent there or went there voluntarily in 1822 for the first time, independence in 1847. We've had
the idea of it being a homeland for former slaves in North America. In part.
Abolitionists right. were right. the major movers, mm-hmm. but you know who their partners were in getting the freed blacks over there? Southern slaveholders who were afraid of a rebellion. And also Christian missionaries who wanted to spread the word. So it was kind of a mixed motivation. They got there. Essentially peaceful rule, but there were already some 16 indigenous tribes who mm-hmm. said, excuse us. We've been here too.
We've been here, right.
As you know, there was a coup, 14 years of brutal, really among the ugliest civil wars ever. United States, however, has remained a special partner. By the way, those first Liberians were called Americo-Liberians because they were so
stuff.
Close
yeah.
to us. Still very close to us, but once again, in my interview with President Johnson Sirleaf, I asked her about the relationship with the U.S., and I asked her if she had yet spoken to President Obama.
We were waiting for an opportunity when he was doing the telephone rounds and we were on the list to be called. And then I think it was back to Pakistan and something diverted and all the calls were then suspended after he made the first 5 calls. So we're still waiting for that opportunity.
That's fascinating. What does that say?
I think what it really says is that President Obama has a lot of things on his plate or plates and that he's going to get around to making all of his goals when he gets around to them. But
although you could also say he might have heard from Michelle about, you need to call Ellen Johnson Sirleaf back, perhaps. I mean,
well, let's
know.
Give him the message right now.
Right.
By the way, this is a country, Liberia, that still adores George W. Bush. There is a bridge named after him. There will be, according to the U.S. ambassador, who I also interviewed, that'll be in another piece upcoming. She thinks there'll be a lot of babies named George Bush coming up.
Indeed, that's one of the legacies of George W. Bush with implications we're going to see as we go forward. Lynn, you're going to stay with us on the program when we talk a little bit later about aid to Africa. Thanks so much for that profile of Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who's on her way here to the United States. First woman democratically elected to lead an African nation, Liberia. Lynn Scherr, special correspondent for World Focus on PBS. Thanks so much. We'll return to Africa in a few moments, bring you back into that discussion. But first, headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes after the hour. President Obama lays out his new strategy in Afghanistan today. He's expected to call for another 4,000 military trainers. The president will also boost aid to Pakistan to $1.5 billion a year. Those funds are conditional. Pakistan only gets the money if it does more and meets certain goals in terms of getting rid of militant havens. The basic goal is preventing militants from hurting U.S.-backed governments in the region or launching attacks on America and allies. Later today, President Obama meets with the heads of the country's biggest financial institutions. They'll talk about proposed new financial regulations. He wants to get an update on credit markets and discuss how the CEOs can help revive the economy. The White House says the president knows recovery won't come without healthy banks and financial institutions. One of the world's most prestigious medical journals, The Lancet, says Pope Benedict is threatening the health of millions of people by discouraging condom distribution. On his recent trip to Africa, the Pope said condoms don't help in the fight against AIDS. They actually make the problem worse. The Lancet says that is completely untrue, and the Vatican should take back those comments. The article was an unusually strong statement from the journal. Editorials in The Lancet don't typically target prominent figures in that way. Also, the CDC has a study about worrying news about how much salt Americans eat.
Thank you, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In just a moment, a profile of a recession hero, someone who actually gave some great advice to some customers that might not have been in his economic interest, but turned out to be very much in their economic interest. Who's a recession hero in your life? Someone who helped you out, a friend of yours, or even something that you might have done? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And Femi, you're in the wrong chair. What are you doing over there?
I'm in the big girl's
sitting
chair.
Sitting in the co-host chair.
Hello. I'm at the main table.
Yes. Welcome. You're back from being out in the recession. We sort of sent you out to respond to a story that was suggested by a listener, Sam Jordan, who was listening in New Jersey and sent us an email saying he wanted us to meet someone who he considered his recession hero. So he said, all right, Fem, pack up a camera, pack up some microphones, take your charms with you, which, of course, never leave you. And the story begins actually in the Sam Jordan kitchen, I believe.
Wait a minute. Yummy. Mom's not supposed to eat those.
Here's one. Okay. Good job.
Look at that.
So we have Sam, and Sam is an education worker for the New Jersey Education Department. We have baby Sophia. She's gorgeous. You'll hear a little bit more from her a little bit later. She's 10 months old. And Silvana is the doting mother. So this is part of their morning routine. Breakfast with the baby. They get up early because the baby gets up early. And, of course, they listen in to the radio.
Economic news just out this past hour. The number of durable goods orders rose by 3.4% last month.
Economists Who's that annoying guy? So, well, that's enough of a plug for the takeaway. But, okay, so they're listening to the news. They're in their kitchen.
And, of course, like many, many young families, the Georgians are actually listening out to the economic news very closely because the credit crunch is biting close to home.
The majority of people that we know who bought around the same time as us, they are struggling or they're going through a period of having to really fight with their banks in order to adjust things or decide whether they need to short sale their house or foreclose. And so those are very scary things.
And it's a scary theme that's throughout their neighborhood. All kinds of homeowners are having these sorts of problems. But Sam and Silvana are in a much better position, and it's because their broker actually steered them?
He was really strict with them. So they bought their first house 3 years ago. The real estate market was booming. Banks were offering them really, really big mortgages. And their state broker gave them a good talking to.
He said, look, you know, you're a teacher. You have a certain budget, you have a certain amount of money that's coming in every month, and you really need to maintain, you know, that budget and not go crazy because the loans that they're giving out, he explained it to us, the loans that they're giving out, it's, you know, it may be good for a year, but 2 years from now, 3 years from now, when it all adjusts, you might get yourself into real trouble.
And the baby's agreeing there. You know, here's the broker who's steering them away from a bigger house they might have had if they'd taken some of these mortgages, which they would have qualified for, correct?
Of course. And it sounds like good sense now, but three or four years ago, the broker sounded like he was a little bit nutty. And even Sam, in retrospect, he sounds a little bit wistful for that big house he gave up.
There were a couple of places that we looked at that we really liked. And we presented the numbers to him, and he said no. I mean, he said, you know, you really should not. That's too much. And it was a little bit disappointing.
Oh, who is this guy? Sam can see that house he turned down, but he's happy he did, right?
He's really happy he did.
What were the numbers? What were the circumstances?
The banks were offering up to $375,000 for a mortgage, and his broker said, you need to go way lower than that. Lower than $100,000. That's
100,000 less than 375,000.
Yes, at least 100,000. So their broker is called Abarish Shahidi. He works in Tenafly, New Jersey, and his approach to business is to treat his clients like family.
I got a call one day. This lovely husband and wife from Israel called, and they wanted to see a house in neighboring town Creskin. And when I met them, I treated them as if they were my children. And at one point, the lady said, I am going to adopt you as my father. I said, God bless you. God bless you. And the lady literally said that, I'd like to, can I call you daddy? So please go for it.
That chuckle is infectious. His name is Behrouz Shahadi.
That's right.
He's, is he Iranian?
He's Iranian. He's got a really distinct business philosophy to life. He says, if I were buying a house, I would want people to treat me the way I treat my customers. But the only thing is, it hasn't saved Behrouz from the recession.
Business is very tough because mostly because of the psychology of the market. Whomever wishes to buy, they're scared. Banks are scared. Last year, I did about 10 loans that the bank went out of business.
So he's making loans, and the banks are in flames. So we're seeing that he saw the recession. It's almost as though he's on the front line seeing what's going on with the banks. He's shielding his clients from mortgages and indebtedness that they can't handle. He must have a family, and I guess it's not unfair to say that. He has a family of clients who must really revere him.
They love him to bits. And even in the midst of the recession, he said, you know, you've got to look for the silver lining. You've got to look for the good news in this. And he even gave us a takeaway.
My advice to people is just relax. See what's in it for you in a positive way. Because it's very easy to get depressed and cry and say, oh, I lost my job. Look at this office. At one point, this used to be so busy, you couldn't even hear yourself think. But look. Nobody's here. I like it. I can't think.
Maybe we could call that an economic indicator, the sound of a real estate broker in an empty office staying positive.
I like that.
He should bottle that laugh. What's his name again?
Behrouz Shahidi. He's a real estate broker from Tenafly, New Jersey.
And our recession sandbagging hero in the middle of the recession. Femi, thanks so much for that.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And now Mark Garrison has some headlines.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 21 minutes before the hour today, Oakland, California holds a funeral for four slain police officers. Thousands of law enforcement from across the U.S. and Canada are expected to attend the morning services. Oakland resident Robin Douglas says one of the officers, Mark Dunnigan, helped solve her son's murder several years ago.
I just thank Sergeant Dunnigan, along with Sergeant Cruz, for putting away the three guys that killed my son.
Mark Dunnigan, John Hagee, Irvin Romans, and Daniel Sakai were gunned down by a parolee at a traffic stop last weekend. A top government bank regulator is placed on leave as he's under investigation. The acting head of the Office of Thrift Supervision faces questions on how cash infusions went into certain banks. His job is to oversee banks that focus on consumer lending. Those banks are known as thrifts. They've been particularly vulnerable to the bad housing market. The U.S. is sending Navy ships to the Sea of Japan, and ahead of North Korea's expected missile test in early April. The ships track ballistic missiles. North Korea says it will launch a commercial satellite into orbit, but many believe that's actually going to be a missile test. The American crews are being diverted from leave in Japan. Colorado is in a state of emergency after a major spring storm smeared heavy snow across the state. The National Guard has been activated there. Also, the Deep South is experiencing severe weather. At least two tornadoes touched down in Louisiana overnight. In Asia, Indonesia is dealing with a different kind of emergency. A dam burst near the capital, Jakarta, killing at least 50. Officials say the final number of dead will likely go higher. John.
Thank you, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It'll be at the top of the global agenda next week. You'll hear it. London hosting the G20 summit. The 20 richest nations on Earth get together to talk about the economic crisis. And it will be a historic gathering. There's no doubt of that. But will there be a consensus on what to do? Remember, it just used to be the G7 richest nations. For context, back in 1933, at the beginning of another historic economic downturn, there was another meeting of nations, rich nations, getting together to talk about their economic future, and that meeting was in London. We spoke earlier with Steve Schiffer, an economics reporter for our partners at the BBC. He'll be covering next week's G20 meeting and has some thoughts about what lessons or issues from that 1933 meeting are still resonant today.
There are a lot of uncanny parallels with the meeting we had in 1933 in London, the last World Economic Summit. Some 66 world leaders came to try to stem the crisis caused by the Great Depression. And another interesting parallel, there was a new leader in the U.S., Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was coming to office, and many people had high hopes that he would essentially come to the rescue of Europe. Very similar in some ways to what we're seeing with President Obama today. The summit, though, in the end, was a lesson essentially in failure, because the leading countries of the world, rather than agreeing an economic plan for recovery, completely fell out over what direction to take. And this had various serious implications.
Now, Steve, you know, at the time, in 1933, what was discredited and which had led to this Great Depression was the problems with the gold standard being the global standard of economic kind of reserves and calculating reserves. In a sense, the dollar has become the gold standard and will be the top priority issue with China calling for a global currency. Does the dollar mirror the sort of gold bugaboo of 1933?
Well, that's right. The gold issue was the issue which the conference fell apart. And that's because, in the end, Franklin Roosevelt realized keeping to a gold standard would hurt his chances of launching the New Deal. At the moment, the situation is slightly different. The dollar is an enormous benefit for the U.S. because it's able to take economic actions that other countries would find much more difficult to take if they didn't have the reserve currency. So the pressure is now on the U.S. from a number of countries, China and to some extent European countries, to have other currency systems that don't just rely on the dollar so that other countries can also benefit. And there's also the fear of what would happen if we don't have agreement on currencies, which is competitive devaluations. And this is what happened in the 1930s. Every country tried to lower the value of its currency to boost its exports. And in the end, everybody lost out.
What's the chance that China emerges as the political economic leader here at this conference and the decline of the U.S. and possibly even the European zone becomes clear?
Well, I think we're going to see a historic change, certainly in the way the International Monetary Fund is run. There's already been a preliminary agreement with the G20 finance ministers that China, as well as India and Brazil, will be given more power. And probably the U.S. will lose its veto power. So there's going to be a big shift in how the world economy is run in the future as a result of this conference.
So consensus or no, this will be a history-making meeting, just like it was in 1933. Steve Schiffers, economics reporter for our partners at the BBC. He will be covering next week's G20 meeting. He spoke to us earlier this morning.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Coming up, aid to Africa, moral imperative, economic engine, or sand in the gas tank? A discussion after headlines with Mark Garrison.
Thank you, John. Coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, just some quick economic report that's just out earlier this hour. Consumer spending has gone up. That's for a second straight month, even as incomes have fallen amid massive layoffs. So we've been watching that. The new White House Afghanistan plan won't focus only on fighting. It will include more than 4,000 American military trainers. They'll be there to instruct the Afghan military. But the president's plan also includes more aid to Pakistan and civilian advisors. The president unveils his plan next hour. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court has voided hundreds of convictions of youth offenders who appeared before former Luzerne County Judge Mark Chivarella. They were in his court from 2003 to 2008. Federal prosecutors charged Chivarella and another judge with taking more than $2.5 million in kickbacks for sentencing juvenile offenders in private detention centers. The judges pleaded guilty to fraud last month and faced sentences of more than 7 years in prison. Over in sports, the college basketball herd continues to get smaller. After tonight, the NCAA men's field will be down to eight. Yesterday, Pittsburgh, Villanova, Connecticut, and Missouri all went forward.
Go Gonzaga against NC. And the women's game is also happening. Thank you, Mark Garrison. So Lynn Scherr, special correspondent for PBS, is still with us. We were talking earlier in the program about the Bush legacy in Africa. It's actually quite a positive one. Here's President George W. Bush during a trip to Tanzania in February of last year.
It's in our interest that we deal with hopelessness, and it's our moral interest that we help. And this has been a labor of love. I told people we're on a mission of mercy.
American leaders and Western leaders often talk about Africa in these terms. $1 trillion of aid has gone to Africa. And here to discuss whether it was a good investment or not is Dambisa Moyo. She's author of a controversial book called Dead Aid about the economic impact of foreign aid on the continent of Africa and whether or not it's a good economic model for any kind of investment or improvement of conditions there. Thanks for coming on, Dambisa.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
And let's talk about, you speak as an economist here. That's right. When you hear the president of the United States, who, as we've already pointed out, is the former president, is very, very popular in Africa for his aid program and for his approach to Africa, talk in those terms about the continent, what's your reaction?
I think it's a disappointment that the debate and the discourse about Africa tends to be couched in the negative. And it's, you know, clearly there are problems across the continent and there remain significant challenges. But to continue to paint the continent in a very negative light is precisely why we end up with an AIDS regime that is couched in pity rather than really looking for new and innovative ways to raise financing to support development initiatives.
Well, let's talk economically then for a moment. The $1 trillion of investment, Dambisa Moyo, where has that gone and where might it have gone if circumstances had been more innovative and entrepreneurial?
Right. Unfortunately, it's not investment. It's just been aid. At the extremes, it's gone towards corruption. There's a long list of leaders in the history of Africa. And even very recently, in the past 6 weeks, we've actually seen presidents such as Malawi have charges brought against them for stealing aid. But, you know, that's just one aspect of the failure of aid. More on the economic side, it's actually been very detrimental in terms of inflation and debt burdens. And then on the political side, it disenfranchises Africans because the government spent a lot of time courting donors rather than being accountable to their people.
Lynn Scher, you witnessed this firsthand. I mean, the big example, of course, of the patriarchy in Africa being supported by both aid and the Western governments who are interested in natural resources is Mobutu in Zaire. Are you agreeing with what you're hearing from Dambisa?
I don't think there's any question but that the model has to change to some extent. And I think investment in Africa, getting the people on the ground involved in their own economy is exactly what it's about. By the same token, I don't think you just wipe out aid. I've just been back, as you know, from Liberia. The United States has more than $2 billion since the war ended. That country would not exist were it not for that money. And the schools would close. Any medical supplies would be gone. Clearly, things have to, and the president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, has said, we want to be self-sufficient. She wants to change the model ultimately. But I don't think you just stop it dead and then hope things will work out okay. I think you've got to keep some of it going.
Well, Dambisa, let's get a critique here. If we're talking about the aid that President Bush was speaking of, the very traditional aid, you're pretty much a critic of that. But what about the Microsoft, you know, Bill Gates Foundation kind of medical, supposedly social entrepreneurship philanthropy in Africa? And then what is China doing? They're not so much an aid engine as they are an investment engine in Africa. What are you observing on those three levels?
I think that's a very important question because there are three types of aid. There's humanitarian aid, which is basically money that we send as a global society towards emergency things such as tsunami and earthquakes. There's clearly a moral imperative there, and so I have no objections to that type of aid. The NGOs and charitable aid that you referred to are relatively small beer to the type of aid that I'm criticizing in the book. And so, I myself sit on charity boards. It can be effective in a very narrow scope, but what I'm trying to emphasize is that a continent cannot expect to grow long-term and alleviate poverty based on the charitable interventions of these charitable organizations from the international community. And besides, we have to ask the question that if international charities continue to provide education and healthcare, infrastructure and security, what exactly is the role of African governments?
Well, let's talk about that for a moment. I mean, I think a lot of people listening might say, you know, at what point does African political leadership bear responsibility for the political situation over there, whether it's skimming off the top of aid and natural resources or allowing charities to run the health infrastructure rather than doing it themselves. I mean, with the possible exception of Johnson Sirleaf in Liberia, you've also got Omar al-Bashir, who's a wanted criminal in Sudan. I mean, the leadership class in Africa is very much discredited in our era, even given the colonial legacy in Africa.
Absolutely. And I suppose in my book, I argue that you cannot delink the two. There is a reason why Africa has had four coups in the past 6 months. There's a reason why Africa in the 1990s had more wars and civil unrest than anywhere in the world combined. I believe that this is really, it emanates from the desire by people for capture of the state, because that is really primarily the source of income for many people on the continent. And it is President Kagame from Rwanda is on record criticizing the aid model. He, like myself, would like to see his country and the continent wean itself off of aid. We know what works. We know that private sector involvement, such as the Chinese coming to Africa, is a good thing. They're bringing jobs. They're bringing opportunities. Yes, there are challenges there, but that is the model. We need to treat African Africans as equal partners, not as a junior partner that continues to receive aid. It's been 60 years, $1 trillion. It hasn't worked.
So are you hearing a brave new world over in Africa from Dembisa, or more of a kind of a Gingrich philosophy applied to Africa?
I hope not.
I'm troubled by the China comment only because I'm sure you saw the article in the New York Times yesterday where China has started pulling back because commodities prices are falling because of the global financial crisis. China is suddenly not looking like the great help, although in Liberia there are Chinese plants all over the place, and clearly they've donated, invested quite a lot of money. So I think you're right, Dambisa, that the model has to change, but I think the word you used, wean, is more important than saying stop it. I think that there needs to be humanitarian aid. There needs to be a lot of thought to this. Yes, indeed, the Africans would like to run their own countries, but I don't think corruption is our fault. I don't think the West is responsible for the downfall of some of these regimes. I think there's something much more important going on there.
Well, Dembisa, I'll give you the last word and a recommendation for Obama on our way out.
To do exactly what he's done to get into power in the United States, which is to innovate. Let's really reevaluate the African situation in the manner in which we're evaluating and the criticism we're evaluating the capitalistic model. It hasn't worked, and there are better ways. So let's just put on a new lens, and I think Obama could lead the charge because he himself is very akin to the notion of innovation.
What aid would you stop tomorrow?
I might add, actually, that in the book I actually prescribe a weaning off. It's a 5-year plan, mm-hmm. and I actually do not suggest that we turn off the taps immediately. I would actually focus on the government-to-government aid that needs to be, I believe, dramatically and aggressively reduced.
Well, the argument you can see laid out on our website. Dambisa Moyo is the author of Dead Aid, A View of Entrepreneurship and the Use of Appropriate Capital in the Continent of Africa, which, as we know, has so many problems. Dambisa Moyo, thanks so much for
being
with us.
Thank you very much.
And Lynn Scher, thanks so much for riding along this hour.
My great pleasure. Great to be with you again.
So our own Femi Oke brought us a story of a recession hero, someone who resisted the temptation of a growing subprime mortgage bubble. We're looking for other heroes, too. Maybe it's for someone who helped you out or for a friend of yours. Here's what Dana from South Wellfleet on Cape Cod had to say.
I certainly encourage individual acts of kindness and charity, but that's not heroism. That's just doing the right thing. What is the takeaway's obsession with the hero as an ideal type? The whole idea is kind of antiquated. We live in a democracy. We have to help each other.
And I'm with Dana. You know, the hero word is like overused. I agree with him. It's not heroism. It's democracy. It's community cooperation. It's doing the right thing. 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Also, go to our website to see a video of Femi with Behrouz Shahidi, the broker. It's at thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
So I say Fargo, and you say,
what do I look like? And I says, well, what do I look like? I don't arrange that kind of thing. And he says, but I'm going crazy out there at the lake. And I says, yeah, but this ain't that kind of place.
Uh-huh.
He says, oh, so I get it. So you think I'm some kind of jerk for asking, only you don't use the word jerk.
With the Red River Rising, that old Coen Brothers movie needs an update and maybe some new stars.
Neighbors are cooperating with each other. New friendships are being built. We don't want this flood. We wish it wasn't here, but we do have a we will beat this attitude.
Heroic Fargo resident John Bolger is sandbagging along the Red River with his neighbors. Saving Fargo, residents hope the sequel has a happy ending. No Steve Buscemi, no wood chipper. You got that going for you. Praying for Fargo. We're doing that on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, March 27th. I'm John Hockenberry. Adora Udoji is away, spending more time with her new baby. Coming up this hour, President Obama is sending more Americans to Afghanistan. We'll preview his new plan for the war there. As for the war on drugs, former Baltimore Mayor Kurt Schmoak has some provocative ideas about it. We'll talk to him. And April 15th is coming right up. Want to get out of taxes? Some bad ideas in a moment. First, these headlines. Within the hour, President Obama will announce a new strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Officials say the White House is shifting its focus to destroying safe havens for insurgents. Army Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry is the nominee for ambassador to Afghanistan. He went before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday, saying there's no substitute for more resources in Afghanistan.
I believe with the president's leadership and direction, and with the support of the United States Congress, we can and must foster the conditions for sustained success inside of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Among the details in the announcement, which we will learn within the hour, 4,000 new trainers or troops into Afghanistan and boosting aid to Pakistan. In northwestern Pakistan today, 48 are dead in a suicide bombing at a mosque packed for Friday prayers. Mark Garrison, what else is going on?
Good morning, John. At the White House today, President Obama is having lunch with about a dozen top bank execs, including those from J.P. Morgan and Citigroup. They're expected to talk about proposed new financial regulations as well as the state of the credit market. And new consumer spending data could be on the menu. In spite of a drop in incomes due to layoffs, consumer spending is up for the second straight month. In Fargo, North Dakota, the town is still bracing for a record flooding from the Red River, as John said. It's resident sandbag. You may not know, it's actually very cold there. It's about 11 degrees now. It's only getting up to 26. Add the wind, that gets even worse. Overseas, police in Northern Ireland have arrested a prominent figure with the murder of two British soldiers. They were shot outside their army base earlier this month. An IRA splinter group claimed responsibility for the attack. Two others have been arrested in the separate killing of a policeman there.
Our prayers with the people of Fargo. That river, the Red River, is supposed to crest at 43 feet sometime over the weekend.
It's worse than what they thought.
Worse than what they thought. All right. Tell us your first of all, the Dow and the S&P are about to open about 30 minutes from now. They closed yesterday about 2% rise. The rally continues. The S&P begins trading at 833. Futures are mixed to down this morning. So give us your suggestion for a sandbagger along the river of the recession, someone who helped you to avoid catastrophe or steered you into a direction that you're grateful for today. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Recession hero stories on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to begin with a foreign affairs briefing from our colleagues at the BBC in London on two stories. The first, a very important unveiling today by Barack Obama of the details of his Afghanistan policy. South Asian policy has already been described as something much more central in the Obama administration than it ever was in the Bush administration. We've already seen increase in troops deployed to Afghanistan. More announcements expected today. Joining us to talk about that is Rob Watson, BBC defense correspondent in London. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Morning, John.
Also with us is Magdi Abdulhadi, who's the BBC Arab Affairs correspondent, who's going to help us unravel a mystery going on in North Africa, which may have implications in the Arab-Israeli conflict. Magdi Abdulhadi, thanks for being with us again.
Hi, thank you. Good morning.
So, Rob, let me begin with you. Barack Obama will unveil this Afghan war strategy today. Clearly, it's a message for NATO nations. What do you think that message is, and what do you think NATO nations are hoping to hear this morning?
Well, I think there are a couple of messages. I think the first message is that the United States is committed to Afghanistan and that it believes that it can come up with a strategy not just towards Afghanistan but also to Pakistan that will make a difference on the ground. I think the other message is, and this is kind of a subtle one, you know, is that really what we're going to be looking at in the years ahead or the months ahead is basically an Americanization of the operation in Afghanistan.
So you see the Obama administration dialing down NATO's role and taking a much more aggressive U.S. role in Afghanistan.
Well, look, you know, I don't think one wants to be too ideological about this. It's not that the United States and NATO are having some kind of a quarrel. This is, you know, in a way, this is just hard facts of life stuff. The Americans have figured out that NATO countries are not going to be able to put a lot more combat troops on the ground. The Obama administration doesn't want to have a row with them about that. It just wants to get on and try and do the best that it can in Afghanistan. Now, that's not to say it's saying, hey, guess what, NATO, we don't care about you. Sure, they want NATO countries to be contributing whatever they can, more civilian advisors, more money. It's just that they've decided we're really going to have to get on with this.
Well, no, it's true.
And I should say that nobody in NATO has got a problem with that. Right.
I mean, exactly. And in fact, this is consistent with Obama's policy of pulling back from some of the linguistic veils of the Bush administration. Was it a coalition or was the U.S. unilaterally acting in Iraq? Those language games were really a feature of the Bush administration. I agree with you. It seems as though the Obama administration is just accepting the reality on the ground. It's a U.S. operation. So militarily and diplomatically, we've got some interesting details. This General Eikenberry, who's going to be the ambassador to Afghanistan, moving from the Pentagon into the State Department. What does that say about a coalition between diplomats and military leaders in the Obama administration as regards, say, President Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan?
Well, I think the main thing it says is that the Obama administration has tried to find someone who really knows Afghanistan well. I mean, General Eikenberry, I certainly remember meeting him in his former incarnation as the commander of NATO operations there. He's a man who knows the country. So he brings a couple of things to the table, doesn't he? He brings the idea that he's going to be someone who can deal with the military in the way that some diplomats find difficult, and he's also going to be able to deal with the Afghans. And I'd throw in a third thing, and that is that he's popular amongst the NATO countries too.
Well, let's speak for a moment about what individuals have said on this program before, and that is that military tactically, Rob, and that's why we brought you on the program this morning, the U.S. needs to rely much less on aerial drone bombardment tactics in Afghanistan if it has a hope of gaining the support of the civilian population. And the complications are even more severe if you talk about Pakistan's northwest frontier territory, where the Taliban has semi-autonomy in the Swat Valley, and the drone use and the use of troops in Pakistan has been really destabilizing. What's the likelihood that Eikenberry and the new team in Afghanistan, General Petraeus, are going to relax the use of these aerial tactics that have been so destabilizing?
Well, I'm glad you brought up the name of General Petraeus, because he's already made clear that he intends to borrow some of the tactics that worked well in Iraq. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's this idea that protecting the civilian population takes precedence over going after the bad guys, certainly as far as Afghanistan is concerned. Because one of the things that General Petraeus and some of the smart young officers around him worked out in Iraq was you could go to a place in Iraq, you could kill a load of bad guys, but if you killed one or two civilians in the process, and even if you didn't, sometimes that could do more harm than good. So, yes, expect to see an avoidance of civilian casualties in Afghanistan on an even greater effort that's existed heretofore. Pakistan, I think, is slightly different, and the Obama administration has given notice that it intends to keep up pressure on the Taliban leaders and al-Qaeda leaders based in the unruly western areas of Pakistan and possibly even beyond.
Finally, on this subject, and I want to move to our other story for this morning, but Rob, give me your assessment. I mean, Hillary Clinton talked about hundreds of diplomats going to Afghanistan. It really sounds like a hearts and minds plan all over again the U.S. is going to try to do in Afghanistan. Do you think there's any chance of, aside from avoiding casualties, of really doing a hearts and minds, grab the civilian population and make them, American patriots?
Well, look, let me kind of answer a slightly different but similar question, which is, do you think this has got a hope in hell of working, right?
Sure.
I guess I'd say, you know, on the plus side, all the opinion poll evidence suggests that Afghans do not want the Taliban, that they do actually are prepared to get help from the international community, and indeed they kind of expect it. So that's on a very positive side. Also on the positive side, the Americans have learned so much from their operations in Iraq that they really are very, very good at counterinsurgency. So that's the good stuff. You're wanted there, and you've got the skills, and you're going to put in the extra resources. But on the bad side, you know, it's going to be a real challenge to persuade Pakistan to take on these Islamic militants who kind of straddle the side of the border. And indeed, that's something that the Obama administration recognizes will be the biggest challenge. You know, there's no point in making progress in Afghanistan if the kind of source of the trouble, the other side of the border, is still continuing to bother you. So that will remain the biggest challenge ahead.
All questions on the table for the Obama administration as the president outlines the details of that South Asian policy later on today. Magdi Abdulhadi, BBC Arab Affairs correspondent. Help us resolve a mystery of a story that's being reported in the West about an alleged Israeli strike in Sudan, which may have killed hundreds of people, possibly an attack designed to interdict weapons going into Israel to aid in the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Well, I'm not sure we can still call it a mystery, because it was a mystery a couple of days ago, but now we seem to have what appears to be a confirmation from American officials talking to the New York Times, and that has been quoted in the Israeli press, confirming that the Israelis did actually launch an air raid on Sudan, targeting a convoy of trucks carrying weapons, allegedly coming from Iran, heading towards through Egypt and up then to Palestinian militants in the Gaza Strip. The strongest indication that the Israelis were involved we had yesterday, that is Thursday, from the outgoing Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. In a typical Israeli fashion, he neither confirmed nor denied that Israel was involved. He simply said, "We will hit hard at any of Israel's enemies, any in the world," and that broadly is consistent with Israel, what Israel has done in the past.
And the patterns of reporting in Israel on this suggest that the story is under censorship, and so you know, that would tend to confirm some of the patterns of Western reporting. The United States, the New York Times, has suggested that American officials have linked this to Iran, the convoy to Iran. What do you have on that?
Well, what we have is exactly what you have.
Right.
The press reports. Iran, of course, doesn't really say that it is smuggling weapons to Palestinian militants or to Hezbollah in Lebanon. This has been the main accusation and the main stumbling block, if you like, in reestablishing normal relations between Iran and Western countries, and that is to stop smuggling or sending weapons to Hamas and Hezbollah. And inevitably, this will be one of the main issues on the table if and when there is talks and negotiations between Washington and Tehran at some time in the future.
So this final question to both of you, Magdi Abdulhadi, what are the regional implications here? Israel carried out an attack in Syria aimed at a nuclear facility, if I'm not mistaken, within the last few years. It had limited regional implications. This is a very different territory. Magdi, what do you think the regional implications are here? And Rob, I'll give you the last word.
Well, I mean, the people who don't like it, say Sudan or Hamas, well, they just be very angry, and there is little they can do about it apart from just continuing to get in weapons into the Gaza Strip. So if there is another confrontation with Israel, they can hit the Israelis.
Hmm. Rob Watson, is this an escalation?
I don't think it'll have any huge implications. I mean, after all, the Israelis say that they'll be tough about these things, and guess what? Sometimes they are.
Well, Rob Watson, a defense correspondent for the BBC, and Magdi Abdulhadi, BBC Arab Affairs correspondent, thanks to both of you for that briefing on two important stories in world affairs this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So to get away from all the negative numbers and the silly sort of bouncing around that the market does, I mean, thinking about the economy, we sent our own Femi Okeh out to bring us a story of some recession heroes. We like to call them. Actually, I like to call them. Nobody else in the entire office does. I'm just stuck on the sandbaggers along the recession river, you know, people who help to steer people away from economic disaster, maybe resisted the temptation of subprime mortgages. We're looking for other heroes from you. Femi found some great stories, but we want to hear yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Femi's story actually was motivated by one of your emails. You know how to reach us at mytake at thetakeaway.org. So at the risk of encouraging the IRS to actually audit me, I invite our next guest onto the program from our partners at WGBH up in Boston. Jason Zangerle is a senior editor at The New Republic, and he has an article in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine called Hell Nay, We Won't Pay. And look at the calendar, folks. We're getting close to April 15th here. It's all about new ways to not pay your taxes by April 15th. Jason Zangerle, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tax resistance is something that goes back to the Shays Rebellion and the beginning of the United States. But certainly the tactics and technology for resisting taxes or avoiding taxes or just sort of basically sticking it to the federal government have evolved over time. What's the latest?
Well, there's several methods. I mean, there's a whole movement. They call themselves the Tax Honesty Movement, and it's people who read the Internal Revenue Code quite closely, and they interpret the language in such a way that they claim they don't have to pay the income tax. They define income in such a way that it can only mean money that's been generated from the federal government. You know, you're paid whether you're a government employee or you have investment dividends through the government. Any other money, say, that you would get from just your regular employer doesn't count as income. And therefore, when you file your W-2 form, you claim no income. And, not infrequently, actually, people will get refunds from the IRS using this method. The IRS will usually come after them later to recoup the money. But that's one method. Some people.
But how do you just say you didn't get any income? You don't try to create an argument using the tax code to say this income.
Well, no. Then
count.
Then when they come after you, you use an argument saying, the meaning of the word includes says that this is not actually income. I mean, it's a very sort of legalistic reading of the tax code itself, referring to all sorts of sections. Sometimes you can go beyond that. You can get into arguments about whether the 16th Amendment was actually ratified. That's a popular argument.
Does that work?
None of these ever work in the end. I mean, since the 16th Amendment was ratified, it's been 96 years. There's really been no legal argument, no successful legal argument against the legitimacy of the income tax. But that doesn't stop people from trying.
Can I try one on you?
Sure. Go ahead.
What if, I chartered myself as a bank holding company and then applied to the TARP to pay my taxes for this year?
You might get some followers from that. You could try that. I think there are probably some people who'd go along with you on that one. I don't know about the IRS, but I think you'd probably find some willing people out there.
The IRS would only care that I pay taxes on the money that I got from the TARP. They aren't even watching the TARP, so I'd probably get $1 billion and have to figure out what to do with it. So what are some interesting stories that you found of actual characters who have tried this and their arguments, and some of them are actually political, for resisting taxes?
Sure. I mean, I think in large part the people in this movement are, you could generally characterize them as libertarian. And I mean, the thing that's interesting is, there are people who sort of rise to prominence. People outside the movement call them gurus. People inside the movement, I guess, just call them leaders. And one guy who I spent some time with, his name is Pete Hendrickson.
Right.
He's a libertarian activist in Michigan. And back actually in the early 90s, he got into some trouble. He was part of a plot to send a firebomb to the IRS.
You know, that'll trigger an audit. That kind of thing will trigger an audit. Yeah.
he was caught and he served a year in prison. Since then, he's you know, reformed himself in a lot of ways. If you just sort of look at his life without looking at the tax component, you know, he has a fairly middle class life in Michigan. He's a soccer dad, but he's developed an argument. He wrote a book called Cracking the Code in 2003, which made this argument about what income is. And he taught people to file what he calls educated returns, in which they file substitute W-2 forms and 1099 forms that claim no income. And people who've used his method have recouped almost $10 million in refunds from the IRS. When they get a refund, they send him their refund check, and he posts it on his website.
Oh,
and,
that's amazing.
Not surprisingly, the IRS, you know, isn't very fond of him. And last November, he was indicted on 10 criminal counts of involving tax charges. He's facing up to 50 years in prison right now.
But he makes a really interesting point in your article, that the whole scheme that delivers revenue to the IRS is a psychological scheme. People are taught to believe that there's really an army of stormtroopers out there. But in fact, almost all tax collection in the United States is voluntary.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and he takes it a little bit further than that. I mean, he claims that, you know, the law is on his side and that the IRS intimidates people from actually looking what the law is. And he says, if you look closely at the law, you'll find that I'm right. And the problem is people are afraid to look closely at the law because they're afraid of the IRS. Yeah, he does. I mean, he thinks there's a big psychological component.
Finally, before we go, are people more or less afraid of the IRS in these dark economic times, you know?
I think they're probably as afraid as they've always been. I don't know if it's more or less. I mean, it's whenever you go to one of these tax honesty movement meetings, before people talk, there's always sort of a nervous chuckle. You know, who in here is an IRS agent? Raise your hand. you know, I just want people. When you talk to some of these folks, they take very great precautions in assuring you that they only work with non-taxpayers, not with taxpayers. I guess that's a sort of legalese that they think would protect them if they ever actually gotten into trouble, since they're not offering tax advice. They're offering non-tax advice.
So advice or delusion. Read all about it in the New York Times Magazine this Sunday. Hell Nay, We Won't Pay, an article written by Jason Zangerli, senior editor at The New Republic, about tax resistors in 2009. And Mark Garrison has some headlines. And the top headline is Afghanistan, right?
Yes. Any minute now, President Obama will outline a new strategy there. He's expected to send 4,000 trainers to work with the Afghan army. He's also boosting aid to the region. Those trainers are in addition to 17,000 troops that he's already approved going there. In just a moment, we're going to have a live conversation with analysis of the new plan as it comes out. In Oakland, California, thousands of police officers from around the country are gathering for a joint funeral for four officers killed on duty last weekend. Oakland City Council President Jane Bruner paid tribute.
I just feel so much for these men who put their lives on the line to protect us. Of course, it's just tragic at the deepest level.
Funeral will be held in a 19,000-seat arena. All of Oakland's police officers will be allowed to attend, and the city's streets will be patrolled by neighboring law enforcement agencies so they can. John.
And we are waiting for President Obama to announce the Afghan policy. Thank you very much, Margaret.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. When he steps to the microphone in the next couple of minutes or so, President Obama is expected to announce the details of the foreign policy, which is expected to be at the center of his strategy going forward in his administration. Afghanistan and South Asia at the center of his strategy. And we've already seen some interesting details more in a moment. And we will go live to President Obama when he steps to the podium to talk about what's been going on. But then we want to talk with Nicholas Schmidl, who's a fellow New American Foundation and author of To Live or Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Nicholas joins us. Good morning, Nicholas.
Good morning.
And Paul Hughes is a senior program officer, Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, and he's a retired U.S. Army colonel. He joins us from Washington. Paul Hughes, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You know, Obama is expected to come out any second here, but in general, how important is this announcement, Paul Hughes?
This is extremely important because it puts the United States in a different kind of context when it gets into when it's re-engaging in a war that had long been forgotten. Bringing together all of the elements of power at one time is very significant.
And we already know that 4,000 trainers are expected to deploy with the 17,000 additional troops the president has already announced, and deployment of diplomats to further sort of create a kind of civilian corps. How significant is that, Paul Hughes?
Well, it's very significant because what we're trying to, what the president intends to do is to cover all the gaps that would exist in this kind of conflict. You could send the military in to deal with just the security issues, but if you don't also send in diplomats and economists and other technical specialists, you wind up leaving gaps that the military then has to hold again, just as we did in Iraq early on. And that's not what we need to do.
Nicholas Schmidl, Pakistan is likely to figure prominently in this announcement as well, correct?
Yeah, I would believe so. But again, it gets back to the fact that Pakistani, sort of what comes out of this announcement vis-a-vis Pakistan can only be affected to such a degree because there's not a significant U.S. presence on the ground. So that, I think that's actually going to be, it'll be interesting to see the way that he tries to negotiate how you deal with a problem in which there are not Americans that are actually on the ground or not a significant American presence on the ground to deal with that problem.
Does the president have diplomatic or some set of incentives that can provide a set of levers to bring Pakistan more into a cooperative posture on these issues?
I think there are all the same diplomatic levers that have been in place for the past 8 years. The problem is just that the Pakistani security services and security establishment, their threat index is still, their concern is still that, well, if the Americans don't stay as long as they say they are, we need to sort of have as many horses in the race as possible. And the question is whether he can pacify that concern. Obama can pacify that concern and give the Pakistanis a reason not to be betting on every single aspect of the fight in Afghanistan.
Paul Hughes, does the president have to mention Hamid Karzai and bolster his credibility, or is this likely to be a distance, a snub?
Well, I think that he really does need to give a nod to the president of Afghanistan. After all, he is the guy who's asking for this increase in American forces and clearly recognizes that he cannot get his job done or that this new modern Afghanistan cannot survive without American assistance. And so the president's going to make that nod. And I think that if you saw Carl Eikenberry's comments yesterday at his nomination hearing on the Hill, he also made that nod too.
All right. So we want to tell our stations that if we do go live to the president, who's expected to speak at any moment about the Afghanistan policy, we will be preserving our clock here, but expect to hear some live remarks from the president and possibly continuing our conversation with Paul Hughes, Senior Program Officer, Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, and a retired U.S. Army colonel, and also Nicholas Schmidl, author of the book To Live and Perish, or To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. Nick, is India going to come up in this announcement?
I think that we're going to see everyone's going to come up. I think that it's going to reflect the tone of the Obama administration's foreign policy priorities, which is being more regional. I think we're going to hear about Central Asia, about China, about India, about Iran, and so I do think that India will come up into this.
What is the Iranian issue? Certainly, the Iranians are going to be sitting down at the table in a discussion of Afghanistan. I believe that conference starts today with the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Hughes.
It was. the Iranians are very concerned that the United States may get too close to the Taliban in a way of engaging the moderate Taliban and perhaps inviting them back into Kabul. Iran has always opposed the notion of a Taliban government in Afghanistan, and so they're very, very concerned that we not take that route. Now, of course, they're not dictating our foreign policy, but that's their interest.
Now, obviously, shifting the focus to the center in Afghanistan is what Barack Obama campaigned on. But Nick Schmidl, is it possible he makes too big of a bet here by focusing so much energy on this region? And again, in the title of your book, To Live or to Perish Forever, it's a very unstable region. He can't project control.
I agree. I mean, I think that he... I don't think that it's possible with these numbers so far that we're seeing that he could sort of overbet his hand. I mean, this is the center of the remnants of the global war on terror, if you will. I mean, now we have a reconstituted al-Qaeda in Pakistan, and I think that it does deserve the attention it's getting. And I think that, you know, the foreign policy agenda of this administration is very much global, and it's not going to get bogged down unnecessarily and forget other foreign policy priorities. But I think that they're right to be putting this much attention in this region right now.
Bets from each one of you. Will Osama bin Laden's name be mentioned in this announcement? Paul Hughes and then Nicholas.
You bet.
Really? I would say no. Nicholas, what do you think?
I would actually doubt if it would. I think we'll hear about al-Qaeda. I think we'll hear about dismantling al-Qaeda networks. But I don't think the sort of wanted poster manhunt, we haven't heard that so far.
It's going to be more regional, less manhunt. Paul Hughes, do you go along with that? Sounds like maybe not.
I think that as a historical reference, you're going to hear Osama bin Laden's name mentioned. But I agree that this administration is not going on a manhunt like the Texans tried.
Well, Paul Hughes, stay with us. Senior Program Officer of the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention. He's a retired U.S. Army colonel. And Nicholas Schmidl, a fellow New America Foundation and author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years in Pakistan. As we've mentioned, we are awaiting President Obama speaking live to outline the details of his Afghanistan strategy. Among the headlines we're expected to hear, 4,000 additional trainers from the 82nd Airborne Reserves to go to Afghanistan to assist in a civilian and military front to increase stability in Afghanistan and also Pakistan. We will go to the president live when we return.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We go now live to the White House, where President Obama is laying out the details and showcasing his strategic team for his policy in Afghanistan. He started speaking about a minute ago. Here he is live.
Plans for Afghanistan.
Before I begin today, let me acknowledge, first of all, Your Excellencies, all the ambassadors who are in attendance. I also want to acknowledge both the civilians and our military personnel that are about to be deployed to the region. And I'm very grateful to all of you for your extraordinary work. I want to acknowledge General David Petraeus, who's here and has been doing an outstanding job at CENTCOM. We appreciate him. I want to thank Bruce Rydell. Bruce is down at the end here, who has worked extensively on our strategic review. I want to acknowledge Carl Eikenberry, who's here and is our ambassador designate to Afghanistan, and to my national security team. Thanks for their outstanding work. Today I'm announcing a comprehensive new strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan. And this marks the conclusion of a careful policy review led by Bruce that I ordered as soon as I took office. My administration's heard from our military commanders as well as our diplomats. We've consulted with the Afghan and Pakistani governments, with our partners and our NATO allies, and with other donors and international organizations. We've also worked closely with members of Congress here at home. And now I'd like to speak clearly and candidly to the American people. The situation is increasingly perilous. It's been more than 7 years since the Taliban was removed from power, yet war rages on. Insurgents control parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan. Attacks against our troops, our NATO allies, and the Afghan government have risen steadily. And most painfully, 2008 was the deadliest year of the war for American forces. Many people in the United States and many in partner countries that have sacrificed so much have a simple question. What is our purpose in Afghanistan? After so many years, they ask, why do our men and women still fight and die there? And they deserve a straightforward answer. So let me be clear. Al-Qaeda and its allies, the terrorists who planned and supported the 9/11 attacks, are in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Multiple intelligence estimates have warned that Al-Qaeda is actively planning attacks on the United States homeland from its safe haven in Pakistan. And if the Afghan government falls to the Taliban or allows Al-Qaeda to go unchallenged, that country will again be a base for terrorists who want to kill as many of our people as they possibly can. The future of Afghanistan is inextricably linked to the future of its neighbor, Pakistan. In the nearly 8 years since 9/11, Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies have moved across the border to the remote areas of the Pakistani frontier. This almost certainly includes Al-Qaeda's leadership, Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. They have used this mountainous terrain as a safe haven to hide, to train terrorists, to communicate with followers, to plot attacks, and to send fighters to support the insurgency in Afghanistan. For the American people, this border region has become the most dangerous place in the world. But this is not simply an American problem. Far from it. It is instead an international
security
challenge.
With live coverage of President Obama on Afghanistan policy, this is The Takeaway.
In London and Bali were tied to Al-Qaeda and its allies in Pakistan, as were attacks in North Africa and the Middle East, in Islamabad and in Kabul. If there is a major attack on an Asian, European, or African city, it too is likely to have ties to Al-Qaeda leadership in Pakistan. The safety of people around the world is at stake. For the Afghan people, the return to Taliban rule would condemn their country to brutal governance, international isolation, a paralyzed economy, and the denial of basic human rights to the Afghan people, especially women and girls. The return in force of Al-Qaeda terrorists who would accompany the core Taliban leadership would cast Afghanistan under the shadow of perpetual violence. As president, my greatest responsibility is to protect the American people. We are not in Afghanistan to control that country or to dictate its future. We are in Afghanistan to confront a common enemy that threatens the United States, our friends.
This is The Takeaway from PRI. We return now live to the White House, where the president is speaking on policy in Afghanistan.
In the hands of violent extremists. So I want the American people to understand that we have a clear and focused goal: to disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and to prevent their return to either country in the future. That's the goal that must be achieved. That is a cause that could not be more just. And to the terrorists who oppose us, my message is the same. We will defeat you. And to achieve our goals, we need a stronger, smarter, and comprehensive strategy. To focus on the greatest threat to our people, America must no longer deny resources to Afghanistan because of the war in Iraq. To enhance the military, governance, and economic capacity of Afghanistan and Pakistan, we have to marshal international support. And to defeat an enemy that heeds no borders or laws of war, we must recognize the fundamental connection between the future of Afghanistan and Pakistan, which is why I've appointed Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, who is here, to serve as special representative for both countries and to work closely with General Petraeus to integrate our civilian and military efforts. Let me start by addressing the way forward in Pakistan. The United States has great respect for the Pakistani people. They have a rich history and have struggled against long odds to sustain their democracy. The people of Pakistan want the same things that we want: an end to terror, access to basic services, the opportunity to live their dreams, and the security that can only come with the rule of law. The single greatest threat to that future comes from Al-Qaeda and their extremist allies, and that is why we must stand together. The terrorists within Pakistan's borders are not simply enemies of America or Afghanistan. They are a grave and urgent danger to the people of Pakistan. Al-Qaeda and other violent extremists have killed several thousand Pakistanis since 9/11. They've killed many Pakistani soldiers and police. They assassinated Benazir Bhutto. They've blown up buildings, derailed foreign investment, and threatened the stability of the state. So make no mistake, Al-Qaeda and its extremist allies are a cancer that risks killing Pakistan from within. It's important for the American people to understand that Pakistan needs our help in going after Al-Qaeda. This is no simple task. The tribal regions are vast, they are rugged, and they are often ungoverned. And that's why we must focus our military assistance on the tools, training, and support that Pakistan needs to root out the terrorists. And after years of mixed results, we will not and cannot provide a blank check. Pakistan must demonstrate its commitment to rooting out Al-Qaeda and the violent extremists within its borders. And we will insist that action be taken, one way or another, when we have intelligence about high-level terrorist targets. The government's ability to destroy these safe havens is tied to its own strength and security. To help Pakistan weather the economic crisis, we must continue to work with the IMF, the World Bank, and other international partners. To lessen tensions between two nuclear-armed nations that too often teeter on the edge of escalation and confrontation, we must pursue constructive diplomacy with both India and Pakistan. To avoid the mistakes of the past, we must make clear that our relationship with Pakistan is grounded in support for Pakistan's democratic institutions and the Pakistani people. And to demonstrate through deeds as well as words a commitment that is enduring, we must stand for lasting opportunity. A campaign against extremism will not succeed with bullets or bombs alone. Al-Qaeda offers the people of Pakistan nothing but destruction. We stand for something different. So today, I'm calling upon Congress to pass a bipartisan bill, co-sponsored by John Kerry and Richard Lugar, that authorizes $1.5 billion in direct support to the Pakistani people every year over the next 5 years. Resources that will build schools and roads and hospitals and strengthen Pakistan's democracy. I'm also calling on Congress to pass a bipartisan bill co-sponsored by Maria Cantwell, Chris Von Hollen, and Peter Hoekstra that creates opportunity zones in the border regions to develop the economy and bring hope to places plagued with violence. And we will ask our friends and allies to do their part, including at the Donors Conference in Tokyo next month. Now, I don't ask for this support lightly. These are challenging times. Resources are stretched. But the American people must understand that this is a down payment on our own future, because the security of America and Pakistan is shared. Pakistan's government must be a stronger partner in destroying these safe havens, and we must isolate Al-Qaeda from the Pakistani people. And these steps in Pakistan are also indispensable to our efforts in Afghanistan, which will see no end to violence if insurgents move freely back and forth across the border. Security demands a new sense of shared responsibility, and that's why we will launch a standing trilateral dialogue among the United States, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Our nations will meet regularly with Secretaries Clinton and Secretary Gates leading our effort. Together, we must enhance intelligence sharing and military cooperation along the border while addressing issues of common concern like trade, energy, and economic development. This is just one part of a comprehensive strategy to prevent Afghanistan from becoming the Al-Qaeda safe haven that it was before 9/11. To succeed, we and our friends and allies must reverse the Taliban's gains and promote a more capable and accountable Afghan government. Our troops have fought bravely against a ruthless enemy. Our civilians have made great sacrifices. Our allies have borne a heavy burden. Afghans have suffered and sacrificed for their future. But for 6 years, Afghanistan has been denied the resources that it demands because of the war in Iraq. Now we must make a commitment that can accomplish our goals. I've already ordered the deployment of 17,000 troops that had been requested by General McKiernan for many months. These soldiers and Marines will take the fight to the Taliban in the south and the east and give us a greater capacity to partner with Afghan security forces and to go after insurgents along the border. This push will also help provide security in advance of the important presidential elections in Afghanistan in August. At the same time, we will shift the emphasis of our mission to training and increasing the size of Afghan security forces so that they can eventually take the lead in securing their country. That's how we will prepare Afghans to take responsibility for their security and how we will ultimately be able to bring our own troops home. For 3 years, our commanders have been clear about the resources they need for training. And those resources have been denied because of the war in Iraq. Now that will change. The additional troops that we deployed have already increased our training capacity. And later this spring, we will deploy approximately 4,000 U.S. troops to train Afghan security forces. For the first time, this will truly resource our effort to train and support the Afghan army and police. Every American unit in Afghanistan will be partnered with an Afghan unit, and we will seek additional trainers from our NATO allies to ensure that every Afghan unit has a coalition partner. We will accelerate our efforts to build an Afghan army of 134,000 and a police force of 82,000 so that we can meet these goals by 2011. And increases in Afghan forces may very well be needed as our plans to turn over security responsibility to the Afghans go forward. And this push must be joined by a dramatic increase in our civilian effort. Afghanistan has an elected government, but it is undermined by corruption and has difficulty delivering basic services to its people. The economy is undercut by a booming narcotics trade that encourages criminality and funds the insurgency. The people of Afghanistan seek the promise of a better future. Yet once again, we've seen the hope of a new day darkened by violence and uncertainty. So to advance security, opportunity, and justice, not just in Kabul, but from the bottom up in the provinces, we need agricultural specialists and educators, engineers and lawyers. That's how we can help the Afghan government serve its people and develop an economy that isn't dominated by illicit drugs. And that's why I'm ordering a substantial increase in our civilians on the ground.
You're listening to the president live from the White House outlining his Afghan policy. It was a speech that he was scheduled to make this morning. We are coming to the end of our time on the air here at The Takeaway. Let's recap for a moment. The president is still speaking. We expect him to go on for a little while longer. The president announced, as we expected, 4,000 trainers to go to Afghanistan to assist in the policy, which he outlined in a very comprehensive way. Mark Garrison is here in the studio with me with the headlines. It seems to me the most important thing is he did not mention President Karzai by name. He referred to the Afghanistan government as elected but corrupt. He referred repeatedly to al-Qaeda and reversing al-Qaeda, and very, very interesting aid program rolled out for Pakistan.
Yeah, the Pakistan part is a big part of that. I mean, they're talking about giving up to a $1.5 billion a year in aid there. I mean, you can see just the visual image. You have Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on the left and then Defense Secretary Robert Gates on the right, so stressing that it's a military and a diplomatic problem that he's working on. So not just military but also aid, economic development.
Well, the entire security team is there. Hillary Clinton, Ambassador Holbrooke, the envoy, and you're also seeing members of Congress mentioned by name, also allies. More on Afghanistan, of course, throughout the week on Public Radio International and public radio stations. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Again, President Obama outlining his Afghan policy live at the White House. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway